Our next proceeding, third of three oral arguments, file A220606, State of Minnesota versus Donald Mark Gray. Appellant is the State of Minnesota. And so a few preliminary comments. For counsel, there is a button, and it looks like you're hunting it down right now to adjust. Very good. And the clock, of course, time noted on there as well. We do ask counsel to identify yourself and your name, who you're representing when you begin your comments. Each party will be allowed 15 minutes, or each counsel, I should say, and 5 minutes rebuttal for counsel for appellant, who's standing ready to go. You may proceed.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel, John Schmidt, Assistant Hennepin County Attorney, on behalf of the State of Minnesota. The Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in State versus Dixon is controlling. They said a confession which alone would not sustain a conviction is enough to survive a motion to dismiss. Here, respondent has three separate confessions, and even if those confessions are not enough to sustain a conviction, they are enough to survive a motion to dismiss for lack of probable cause. We're asking this court to reverse and remand for further proceedings.
Mick, can I ask you, I'm the trial judge, and so we have the case for which it could not withstand a motion of acquittal based on State versus Hall's interpretation of the corpus delicti rule. What do we do with the case now?
Well, so that's at a different stage of the proceeding.
I understand, but it seems like it's kind of intertwined almost necessarily, because we endeavor when we remand a case back, and I understand your point that Dixon seems to apply pretty directly, but yet it's the practical issue. We always try to, at least in best way we can, give some guidance to the district judge to the extent we could or should. Now, maybe we can't and should not, and maybe that's your position, but if that's the trial judge in me asking, now what?
Yeah, I don't think you need to provide that guidance. I think that between Hall and Dixon, that's enough. Hall says that this is about a sufficiency evidence to sustain a conviction. Dixon is the procedural posture of a motion to dismiss for lack of probable cause. And in one situation, they say the Supreme Court has said that a confession is enough to survive the probable cause challenge. It may not be enough, as it was in Hall. I had other arguments that I made to the Supreme Court that I can make to you today, if you want to hear them, about why the three confession here should be enough to withstand a judgment of acquittal. But I don't think you need to reach that issue, because Dixon is on point. And Dixon's a case that, based on where that was at the time, would not withstand a judgment of acquittal, because they did not test for the THC, based on the facts that they had at that moment, would not survive a motion for judgment of acquittal.
Can you, counsel, please tell us what record we can look at in making our review of probable cause?
So the district court's order is really what the record consists of here. And this was already litigated at the Minnesota Supreme Court.
But the district court's record, if we're making a de novo review of probable cause, mm-hmm. we need to look at, we can just set aside the district. I mean, district court isn't record evidence, it's ruling, right? What can we look at if we're just looking at it de novo, besides the amended complaint?
It's clear that the district court, because it quoted from the various documents that it had before it, the letter and other evidence, the corner house records, before it, because it cited and quoted it in its order.
But how are we to evaluate those documents? They're not part of our record.
So, and I think this is law of the case. The Minnesota Supreme Court ruled on it. It's footnote one. The respondent moved to strike all sorts of things in my brief. And the Minnesota Supreme Court in footnote one said, we deny the motion to strike. We are relying on the district court's order. It's clear that the order is sufficient, and we're going to address it based on that.
See, it seems, though, that the Supreme Court, of course, is deciding whether this was an appealable decision, order, and looking at whether it involved a question of law. I'm not 100% sure it decided these are the, this is the record that provides the facts, that on remand the Court of Appeals and doing a de novo review should look at. And also, I'm not 100% sure that it's apparent that the district court was in fact looking at those documents, apparent just from what we see. Now, you guys obviously might know something more about what happened at the trial court, but when we were looking at the court's order, it wasn't clear to me that it was doing anything more than citing to what the state described in its memo of law about the underlying records. But the underlying records don't appear. It's not that clear to me that I can say with certainty the district court was definitely looking at the original, you know, the actual documents, source documents.
Sure, but I don't know how the court could have quoted from these various documents in its order and very specifically without...
I guess so. Maybe it quotes beyond the quotes from the state's brief. The state also put in a memorandum of law that quoted from the records. I'm not sure... Yeah, so anyway, I'm not sure. We can't tell what the district court was actually looking at.
And so let me go back to the law of the case portion of this, because when I filed a petition for review, I raised two issues. One was the dismissal of the appeal, and the other was the merits. And at the Minnesota Supreme Court, we focused quite a bit, and the Supreme Court granted the petition in total. We briefed both issues, and they decided it on the narrowest grounds possible, which is to reinstate the appeal and send it back based on State versus Dixon, and expressly said this court should consider State versus Dixon in the ruling in that decision. So I contend it is law of the case.
What's the law of the case that you're saying?
That the record is sufficient in order to review this for probable cause determinations and say that Dixon controls and that a confession is enough.
Is there sufficient... Just indulging me, let's look only at the amended complaint and not get into the questions of what constitutes the record that we can look at. Is there probable cause based on the amended complaint?
Yes. The amended complaint...
Speak to that?
Yep. The amended complaint discusses the confessions. The confessions are enough to survive a motion for probable cause. And that's all you need to do. You don't even need to talk about what particular records before the court. The complaint was clearly before the court. And in the complaint, it talks about confessions, and under State versus Dixon, that's enough to survive a motion to dismiss at this stage in the proceeding.
Can I indulge you? I'm thinking of the same kind of question I had before, because it seems so unique, well, in many ways, procedurally, but the arguments to the district court and what the district court analyzed was whether a confession of a confession satisfies the corpus delicti rule, statute, doctrine, and but for the reasons you indicate, of course, and that was the argument, is the argument. It was briefed to us, and I assume I didn't really look closely at the briefs at the PFR because you said it was accepted in total that was one of the issues, and so, but because of Dixon, and I appreciate this point. There's sufficient probable cause, but insufficient for a conviction. Doesn't it seem important or behoove us, because everybody's briefed it, argued it, the district court's actually ruled on it, for us to somehow give direction on that so that when it goes back to the trial court, the procedural, that issue has now been resolved. Otherwise, I suspect you'll raise the same point, and it's already been addressed once by the trial judge, the exact same issue.
I don't think the court should address it, especially if you rule on State versus Dixon as controlling, because I think the rest of the decision would be dicta and not necessarily controlling on that issue with the three confessions corroborating one another.
So dicta and a non-precedential opinion would be even less persuasive, is your point,
well,
to anybody?
Yes. Yeah, because and here's the problem. We don't know the exact evidence that's going to be introduced at trial. What we have is some records here, and that's what the district court relied on. And so if the evidence comes in at trial, and this is all that we have, then the district court's in a situation where Hull could be controlling, and the court will have to make a decision of, do I let this go to the jury? Does the jury render a verdict, and I take it away because of Hull? There's lots of different things that can happen, and what needs to happen at this point in time is that at the motion to dismiss stage, to let it go forward and see what the evidence is that comes in trial. And if there is something beyond the three confessions, that issue's gone. We don't have to address whether one confession can corroborate another confession and can corroborate another confession. And I apologize, I had a very bad speech impediment, so that word is hard for me to say. But that issue would not need to be decided, because now we're outside of Hall. That's not an issue anymore of whether these confessions can sustain a verdict. But right now, where we're at, we're squarely within Dixon. And so I think providing guidance on my arguments about McLean and how that's distinguishable from Hall are not things that the court needs to address. Now, I'm happy to answer questions if you want to go down that road, but I don't think the court needs to. And with that, I will give up the rest of my time and answer additional questions on rebuttal.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And counsel for respondent, I see you know what to do next. You may approach the podium. You may identify yourself, and then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Counsel, I'm David Risk, R-I-S-K, on behalf of respondent Donald Gray. Your Honor, I am perplexed based on the legal issue that was presented to this court in the memorandum after the court ruled, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled in Gray. The legal issues presented to this court, did the district court err in dismissing counts 1 and 2 for lack of probable cause by determining that subsequent confessions could not be used to corroborate a prior confession? That is the issue on appeal. That was the reason the state was able to get an appeal in the first place. I argued successfully originally to the Court of Appeals that this was a factual question. The court decided it. There shouldn't be an appeal. The Court of Appeals agreed. The Supreme Court took it up. And the point of the argument and the reason the Supreme Court ruled the way they did is because the district court relied on this question whether or not one confession can corroborate another. Well, the Minnesota Supreme Court didn't answer that question for us. I submit, and I'm more than happy to argue why it didn't need to, because it's already answered that several different times in the past. But that was the legal question that the court relied on when putting their facts into context. Whole separate issue of what were those facts, and we can certainly argue about or discuss that as well. But the court made a probable cause finding, not a possible cause finding, by the way, but a probable cause finding based on that legal ruling, which is why the state was able to appeal it as opposed to simply refile. If it was simply a fact question, the state could have refiled. So we're here because of that legal issue. And now the state says, well, Dixon came out later. I appreciate that counsel for respondent, well, actually, they don't say this, but I've never had an opportunity to make an argument about why that doesn't make sense. And I appreciate, well, it wasn't my case that decided Dixon, but I will note, Dixon is not a crim sex case. Dixon was a case where they knew the scientific evidence was coming down the road or wasn't, either way, but that's a very different scenario than what we have here.
Go ahead.
Oh, please,
if you want to finish
up.
I think what you haven't used this word, but I think you're arguing essentially this argument is forfeited.
Correct.
And when I look at the district court proceedings and what the district court decided, the district court is deciding whether, it cites to Rule 634.03, which is what Dixon is about, which is essentially whether at a probable cause, whether you need the corpus delicti, right, on top of a confession. I mean, the word corroborate is never used in that statute. It's almost, I know that it's being used to say that I think that the corpus delicti corroborates the confession, but it's really sort of that a confession without the corpus delicti is not enough to sustain a conviction. And the question under Dixon is, however, whether confession alone without the corpus delicti is sufficient to sustain probable cause. And the Supreme Court directed us, that we should consider, remanded to us to consider in light of Dixon. So with that framing, putting aside a forfeiture argument that, for purposes of argument here, if we look at the amended complaint, applying Dixon, and the amended complaint alleges that in his report to Child Protection, number one, Gray stated that he touched AG's chest skin to skin while at AG's home in Edina. Number two, that he stated admitted in a statement to the investigator, he admitted to both instances of sexual abuse, referring to both the one in London and the one in Edina. And said, quote, the offense occurred in the fall of 2015 when he was staying with a family. Why isn't that sufficient under Dixon to establish probable cause?
And, Your Honor, I guess I'm in a position to note that I need to try and attempt to distinguish Dixon on its facts, and I realize that the Supreme Court was not making an argument about Dixon based on its facts, but rather on 63403 based on the wording of the statute. And frankly, my take is on the use of the word conviction, and we're not dealing with conviction, we're dealing with probable cause. Again, though, this is a crim sex case, and the reason I draw that attention is because the court asked, well, what does the trial court do here? What the trial court does here, apparently, despite the fact that based on all the information we have, assuming I'm right that one confession can't, quote unquote, corroborate another, that this conviction, should it happen, can't stand. Minnesota Supreme Court, one of the questions I received at argument, which again, we hadn't been talking about this issue at all, but one of the questions was, well, but counsel, you never know what the evidence is gonna be at trial, so maybe something would come in to corroborate. Well, again, this is a probable cause standard, not a possible cause standard. And the harm—
Is there a claim that the face of the complaint is deficient?
Your Honor, the face of the complaint is deficient.
And what is the deficiency?
Unless there's a strict reading of Dixon that says, look, this is not the time to make this argument, end of story. The reason I argue it should be the time to make the argument is because in a crim sex case, Your Honor, you have incredible stress placed on the alleged victim, on the defendant, and frankly, on the jury itself. My last criminal sexual conduct trial I had regarding a child in Ramsey County, they're changing how voir dire is done specifically in criminal sexual conduct cases because of the impact that the trial courts have seen on the jurors, on the prospective jurors, and how difficult it is to sit through it.
And I totally understand that, as you know, but that's a different stage of the proceeding. We're talking about very preliminary, face of the complaint. Did the state charge enough to say a crime has been committed here? And I'm looking for what about the complaint itself, in light of Dixon, is missing? What's missing there? What else did they have to plead in that complaint?
Your Honor, I guess what I would argue is not so much what they would have to plead in the complaint, and I realize I'm coming back to the forfeiture argument, but rather what they needed to argue based on the defense probable cause motion. Because if a simple confession, or an alleged confession, I should say, is sufficient for probable cause, which again is what Dixon would appear to say in the context of a drug case where the science was what was missing, not the memory of a child. If that is the case, then the only thing that's missing is the state's argument that, Judge, this is the wrong stage. We came up for probable cause contested hearing several times because the state was not prepared to make any arguments or do anything at the time. There is a complicated history in the trial court, but the only thing that's missing from the face of the complaint, and I understand why this isn't really an answer to your question, is the argument that that's all they need later. That's not what they argued. They argued that one confession can corroborate another, and that's not true, and that's back to the forfeiture argument.
If the amended complaint, had included what it included, in addition, referenced that there was a corner house interview in which the child discussed, well, actually, I understand there's some, like, argument about what the child was discussing in that, but also there's information from the parents that the child's behavior changed, et cetera. Some things that come up typically to corroborate, or to prove, I should say, sexual assault of a child. Is there a problem then? What if those other sources of information were referenced?
And Your Honor, if those other sources of information were referenced, the defense argument would be, The quote-unquote changes in the child afterwards, well, we have two separate allegations, one from the United Kingdom, which, by the way, the state, after being told there's no jurisdiction, charged my client with anyway, and we had to argue about that. But aside from that, Your Honor, the changes, any of those things that changed, these other pieces of evidence that might substantiate a conviction or corroborate, they're not attributable to this instance. They could just as easily be attributable to the matter in the UK, the matter that the child did recall.
So what in a set you seem to be arguing that a sexual assault cases, and let's put it specifically, a sexual assault involving a child, a sexual abuse of a child, what do you think the evidence would need to, or the evidence cited in an amended complaint would need to be in order to get past 34.03 under your reading?
Sure.
Or past Dixon, at least.
Understood, Your Honor. And what I would argue is that the person who is allegedly harmed needs to know that there was a harm, needs to be aware that this thing happened. Like, back to Hall, I mean, in Hall, it was insufficient, despite the fact that the child in question remembered a specific incident separate from the other incidents of where while they were hunting and this happened. But the Minnesota Supreme Court said, no, that's something else. That's duck hunting, not deer hunting. And so it needs to be something that specifically corroborates that this crime occurred. And again, I want to be clear. The issue is this crime. It's not, the court's absolutely right. It's not about corroboration. It's about, is there evidence of the underlying crime itself? And the reason we have that rule, as the court knows from Hall, is because there, back in England in the 1600s, there was a person and his wife and daughter who were killed based on a confession to a murder when the person never died. The person was found a couple years later. So that's why there's such a need to corroborate the crime itself.
We're on the same track, of course. Mm-hmm. Tell me why, what I think you're arguing is, Dixon doesn't apply in this type of case. The rule of Dixon is just different, or that Dixon doesn't have a rule that applies to this case. And why would that be?
And Your Honor, my argument would be that Dixon, frankly, my argument is that Dixon is so unsound, and I get that that's not your place to say, but that it should be limited to its position, which is in a drug trial where the issue is there is a substance, we know it's a substance, and quite frankly, there was a crime. Either way in Dixon, because either it is a simulated controlled substance or it was a real controlled substance. Both of those are crimes. So either way in Dixon, there was a crime. The court could have decided Dixon based on that, but instead the court took this reading and parsing of 63403. So my argument is simply that this type of case, and frankly most types of cases, are so different from what happened in Dixon and what the ailment in Dixon was. And again, Dixon could have been decided a different way, so perhaps it's all dicta. I get why that, for me, that's what makes sense. And again, making a trial court, making a victim, making a jury sit through this whole trial only to find at the end that, well, that conviction can't stand, I think is a deplorable waste of resources and frankly, emotional hardship on a lot of different people. And so that's why I would strongly urge this court to find a way to differentiate Dixon or to say, look, simply put, the state never argued that. The state argued about whether or not one confession can corroborate another. That's what we're here on. That's why they got to go up on appeal anyway. That's why the Minnesota Supreme Court allowed this appeal to come back to the Court of Appeals and so decide that question, the question that is the legal issue presented by the state in its brief to this court. Decide that issue. Decide that that one confession cannot, quote unquote, corroborate because it doesn't do anything to tell us if the underlying crime actually occurred. There's lots of reasons to look at that, and obviously they're in my brief, and I'm happy again to discuss any of those. But make that argument. Make a ruling on what's before this court.
Where do you think it was forfeited? At the district court, at the briefs to us the first time, briefs to the Supreme Court, briefs to us the second time? Where was that forfeited?
I would argue that it's most clearly forfeited in the trial court, but that it is forfeited all the way through because it never came up at all until the Supreme Court asked me a question in oral argument about it.
And the it never came up is what?
It is the question of whether or not a probable cause stage is the right stage to raise this argument.
I mean, it's just in the district court's order, the district court is ruling based on 640.34.03.
Correct. Okay. And again, that the court made what I would call a factual decision on 634.03. The state said, no, it wasn't a factual decision. They made a legal conclusion regarding whether one confession can, again, I appreciate the bad language, but whether one confession can corroborate another. That was the legal argument that got them up on appeal. So address that legal question. Was the trial court wrong about that or not? I would submit that they absolutely were not wrong, and therefore we go back. Now, interestingly, the state can obviously just recharge, just like they asked the Minnesota Supreme Court to clearly let them know that they could. They can. They can go back and recharge, and then we'll argue again. And at that point in time, Dixon is going to be a real complication for the defense at probable cause. But that's why these cases are supposed to go not be appealed when they're factual questions. If the state can refile, that's what they should do. That would have saved us well over a year, and we'd be back and dealing with things. Thank you, Your Honors. I do request that this court rule that the trial court was correct, that one confession cannot corroborate another, and affirm the trial court's order. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to address the forfeiture issue. At the district court, we argued that these three confessions are enough to survive probable cause. We did talk about confessions corroborating one another, but we didn't make an argument about the critical stage of this versus the critical stage of sufficiency of the evidence after a trial. Dixon wasn't issued at the trial court level. It wasn't issued when we argued it at the Minnesota Supreme Court. Justice Moore, who authored Dixon, asked a question that was related to that because they were clearly working on the decision, and it came out about a few weeks after the oral argument. And the Supreme Court couldn't have been more clear. The Court of Appeals should consider the state's appeal in light of Dixon. Dixon is analyzing the exact same statute that is at issue here, and Dixon made very clear that the procedural posture does matter. Now, I contend that this is not forfeited because we were arguing we have enough here to survive probable cause. These confessions are enough. We didn't make the procedural distinction, but Dixon says that matters. That is good law now, and this court needs to consider it in light of the Supreme Court's decision in this case. The other piece on the forfeiture side, we never had a chance to brief this issue before this court. Respondent filed a motion to dismiss the day after I filed the notice of appeal. We ended up dismissing the UK claims on appeal because we agreed those should not go further. We challenged this, but it was dismissed on those grounds, and we did a petition for review, and they granted the entire case, the appellate issue and the confession issue. So the whole thing was before the court. So this is not an issue that is forfeited. It is very much alive, and the court should decide it. I really don't see the difference with this case of the distinction of Dixon not being a crim sex case compared to this case. It's right on point. It's the same statute. It's about one confession. Here we have three confessions. That is enough. Dixon controls, and this court should reverse and remand and send it back for further proceedings. Unless the panel has any questions?
There are none.
Thank you very much.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today, your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, and this concludes our oral calendar today. Have a good day.
Thank you.